Hello and welcome to Unquestionably Nerdy, the show where we talk about everything that makes us want to geek out, freak out, and take a bowl of chaos, a cup of primordial waters, mix it together, and honestly just see what happens. I am one of your hosts, Cannon MacArthur, and today I am joined by... nobody, actually. It's just me. I killed Cole. Finally, I'm free. Not actually. Cole is a busy boy, and he is off doing other important stuff that I don't have on my to-do list. Far more important stuff than I have. So for today, I'll actually be doing my first solo episode. I know you're all very excited. So this is, of course, my first episode without any color commentator to assist me in making any of this at all interesting. So I'll try my very best, I promise. But since this is my first solo episode, I wanted to do a topic that was very, very me, very specific to me, an interest that I hold near and dear to my heart. And today, of course, I have chosen, as you've seen from the title, mythology. I have always been, from day one, a big ol' mythology nerd. Yes, of course, I read Rick Riordan as a child. Yes, I did get into it from the Logan Lerman movie to start, and it is all expanded from there. I honestly credit that writing, those books, those stories, Rick Riordan himself, good old Uncle Rick, with a lot of my, where a lot of my interests have come from in my modern day, a lot of how my personality has formed, honestly. But that being said, we're not going to talk specifically about Percy Jackson in this episode, even though I would love to do an episode on Percy Jackson and possibly Rick Riordan and his different series overall, but we'll save that for the future. Today, we're going to focus on a more specific mythological topic. We're going to keep it, you know, nice and easy breezy, super simple topic for the first episode. So we're only today going to focus on the beginning of the universe, right? Super simple. We all get it. Easy and to understand. And by what I mean by that is we're going to talk about creation myths. We're going to go into a little bit of information on a couple different creation myths in mythology, in different mythologies, and we're going to break it down. We're going to find interesting points. We're going to talk about aspects of these cultures that are reflected in said cultures and their stories. Aspects of the culture that are reflected in the culture. You can tell this is my first solo episode. We're going to talk about aspects of these cultures that are reflected in these stories. And just to give everybody a little forewarning, I'm by no means a historian. I did a little bit of research going into this episode, but a lot of my personal knowledge of mythology does come from the, you know, popular conception, the pop culture conception of these stories, the modern takes on these stories. I do enjoy going into, like, the more, you know, quote-unquote original versions of these stories. Yes, I know, there's no such thing oftentimes as the original story, because these stories, these myths, are too old for us to actually go back and find very original sources and find out who's telling the right version when, et cetera, et cetera. But I'm going to be telling these stories. I'm going to be recounting bits and pieces of these myths from my own recollection and the notes I've taken. So don't expect this to be a peer-reviewed document or peer-reviewed essay. It's just off the cuff, a little bit of fun, a bunch of mythology nerds talking about mythology. So let's just get started talking about Greek mythology. It's the one we probably all know best. It's, you know, Greek mythology is, of course, the Greco-Roman mythology is the area of mythology, in the West, at least, in the Western part of the world, Western Europe and America. It's the mythology we look back on the most. It's the mythology we know the best. It's the mythology that we're inspired by the most. It's the story of Hercules and Zeus and Medusa and Poseidon and Percy Jackson. And of course, it's where I got my start in my appreciation for mythology. So that's where we'll get started. We're going to talk about different mythologies, one or two other mythologies, and their creation myths. But we're just going to get started with the good old Greek. And where better to start with Greek mythology and its creation myth than before everything existed. Essentially at the start of everything, before there was the earth and the sky and then the underworld and whatever else, there was chaos. And what's interesting about chaos is how it's kind of differently depicted than how it is in other mythologies or belief systems, where a lot of the time chaos is depicted either as like the sort of formless state of existence, and sometimes it's instead depicted as a figure, an entity, a deity even, this primordial entity that came before everything that represents or embodies this random force of creation and occurrence. And out of this random state of existence comes the other primordial entities, the other primordial deities, that being Gaia and Eros and Tartarus and eventually Erebos and Nyx, these other primordial entities, each representing, of course, their own foundational aspects of creation. Gaia representing Earth, Eros representing love, Tartarus being the abyss, or we eventually come to know Tartarus as a lower point of the underworld, place of imprisonment for the Titans and other sort of lower punished entities in the Greco-Roman mythology. But we also have Erebos representing darkness and Nyx representing night. And if I can go on a little bit of a tangent to look at chaos, I don't know, I just find chaos as an interesting concept in different mythologies, because it kind of exists in different forms or different depictions in other mythologies. Chaos in Greek mythology, we see it as this creative force, or this sort of random state of existence where anything can and will occur, and eventually creation occurs from it. We kind of see it in a similar sort of way in Norse mythology, in a certain light, in the form of Gnúmlagap, this wide open emptiness, this gap, this abyss, this sort of absence of existence from which eventually Niflheim and Muspelheim come into being, and that sort of creates the eventual world by their meeting. So two forces that very much represent creation in their depictions of chaos. And then you have something like Egyptian mythology that kind of has a very similar depiction of chaos in the sort of primordial waters that the sort of first deities first come from. And it's a creative force in that way. But also at the same time, you have Apophis, the gigantic apocalyptic snake deity, demon, monster, thing, whatever, which we'll get into more of that when we discuss the creation myths with Norse and Egyptian mythology. But it's this destructive, this entropic force that brings about an end to existence, sort of closing out the world in the same way that it came in, this chaotic force. I don't know, I just find it interesting. I just find it interesting that, you know, we take these very broad concepts of chaos, the sort of state of the universe that is structureless and orderless and lawless, and anything can occur here. And out of that, we often times see creation. Isn't that neat? Is it just me? Is that not neat to anybody? In a state where anything can occur, very monkeys on a typewriter writing Shakespeare, we choose to see this chaotic, lawless state of existence as a space for creation. I don't know. Maybe I'm looking too deep into it. Maybe it's just me. I think it's neat. But that's chaos. And chaos in the Greek sense is, like I said, it's often depicted as this embodied personality, this force, this figure, this person that, and if you see it in this way, it's sort of giving birth to or fathering these primordial entities in the form of Gaia and Eros and Tartarus and Erebos and Nyx, which is, again, sort of putting a face to these forces, which is, of course, a very common thing for religions and belief structures to do. It's putting a face to chaos. It's putting a face to where we come from. But yeah, out of chaos comes these primordial entities. Gaia eventually goes off herself to make Uranus. And Uranus and Gaia, they couple and eventually begin to turn out the first generations of deities and monsters in the form of the Titans and the Hecatoncheires and the Cyclopses, etc., etc. But before we go on to more about that, I want to, again, take us back to a previous point to go off on another tangent, and that being Eros. I was thinking about this the other day in the car because I was thinking about this podcast episode, and I don't know. I'm sure we'll have time to bring it up in a later mythology episode. I'm sure we can do whatever we want. But I just wanted to bring up the fact that one of the primordial deities at the same table with Gaia, the earth, and Tartarus, the abyss, and Erebos, darkness, absence of light, and then Nyx, night, no day for life to occur. In all of that primordial soup that produces these gods, in the foundation forces of creation and the universe and everything that comes after, you have the embodiments, the deity, whatever you want to call it, of love. I'm going to say it again. Isn't that neat? What does that mean? What does that mean? Why is love here? I know, like, if you look at Greek mythology overall, we have, like, the Olympians, for example, that sort of tribe of gods. Like, we have such big concepts as Zeus, and the god of the skies, and Poseidon, the god of the seas, and Ares, the god of war. And then you have Dionysus, the god of getting drunk at parties. The scales of these concepts are very you know, spread out. But you could, of course, say that these deities in the Olympians' case are paired up because of their shared importance to Greek culture. You know, the sky is very present, the sea is very present, and of course, wine and celebration and partying and madness and stupor is very important, of course. And you could kind of say the same thing about Eros, in a way, right? Eros, the embodiment of love, is around from the very beginning. As soon as there is existence, love exists. What? It's just neat. And it kind of paints a picture, a small corner of a picture, that tells you something about ancient Greek cultures. Of course, different cultures in the Hellenistic world would have different tellings of these stories. But the fact that Eros takes such a place of importance, it tells you something about how Greek cultures told these stories, how Hellenistic cultures viewed the importance of love. And of course, you can broaden that to love or lust or even companionship and community, right? Togetherness, right? And when you look at Greek mythology overall, and everybody likes to make the jokes about how all of Greek mythology occurs, and all the problems in Greek mythology, and all the problems for mortal kind in Greek myths, all the problems occur because Zeus got horny, which is true and funny. But when you go back to the creation myth and see the fact that the embodiment of love is around from the very start, it kind of paints it in a different picture, because Zeus is the head of the pantheon in the sort of, you know, the quote-unquote modern age that we find ourselves in the view of Hellenism, of this Greek religion, or this Greek united Greek religion. Zeus is the head of the pantheon. So, of course, he would be shaped by or representative of these wider primordial forces. I don't know. tell me if you have any thoughts on this. Maybe it's just me. Maybe I'm going crazy. I just think it's neat that of all things, love is present at the beginning of the universe. But that's my little tangent for Eros. I'm sure I have more thoughts, but this tangent is long enough. So, Gaia and Uranos have coupled. They have bred the Titans and the deities that will soon become the Titans, and they have bred the Hecatoncheires, they have bred the Cyclopses, and Uranos, asshole that he is, big god of the sky asshole that he is, views these uglier, more monstrous offspring in the form of the Hecatoncheires and the Cyclopses, and he deems them not to suck. He don't want to look at them, so he bashes them down into Tartarus, right? Puts, I think, Campy, the sort of monstrous Campy, at the gates of Tartarus to act as their warden, basically. And Gaia then goes to Cronos, the head of their children, to essentially get him to betray and castrate Uranos, and thus ends that generation of deities, and the gods of Cronos, gods and goddesses of Cronos' generation, his siblings, the children of Gaia and Uranos, are named the Titans by Uranos, Titan meaning stretcher, because they were stretching beyond their means, and they take their place at the head of the universe, basically, and that is the beginning of that generation of deities and the world. Eventually, Cronos goes on to marry his sister Rhea. Don't worry about it. They're gods. They do it all the time. It's the hot new thing. They get married and they have a bunch of kids, including Hades. Let's see if I can name them all. Hades, Hestia, Poseidon, Hera, and Zeus comes last. I think I got them all. Hades, Hestia, Hera, Poseidon, Zeus. Zeus is the youngest. Zeus is the youngest child, and Cronos essentially fears that, in the same way that he overthrew his father, that one day his children will overthrow him. And so he, as each child is born, he eats his children. You all know the story. It's your favorite. He eats his kids. But eventually, like Gaia was disappointed with Uranos banishing their children, Rhea, the wife of Cronos, queen of the universe, Sly Queen, gets fed up with Cronos eating her children, who wouldn't, and instead, when baby Zeus is born, gives a swaddled, blanket-wrapped rock to Cronos to eat instead of Zeus. Apparently, Cronos doesn't chew his food. Zeus is then brought up in seclusion, in secrecy, to eventually free his consumed brothers and sisters, his siblings, in order by getting his dad sick so that he throws them up. With his deity siblings free, he is then able to begin fighting against the Titans, the previous generation of gods, but they're not strong enough. They're not strong enough to defeat the gods, the previous generation of gods, the Titans, and so Zeus goes about freeing the Cyclopses and the Hecatoncheires. I've said Cyclopses and Hecatoncheires for a couple times now, so if you don't know what those are, Cyclopses are, of course, the one-eyed giants. You know them from The Odyssey. Can't wait for Christopher Nolan's The Odyssey. And the Hecatoncheires are 100-handed, 50-faced giants. Makes them pretty good at throwing big rocks at the Titans and assisting with the war after Zeus frees them. Makes them very handy. Handy. Get it? God, I'm funny. And at the same time, the Cyclopses are great smiths, so they are able to forge Zeus's lightning bolts and Poseidon's trident and Hades' Helm of Darkness. The girls don't get anything for some reason, because it's ancient Greece, I guess. But with the freeing of the Cyclopses and the Hecatoncheires, that is the point where the tide is turned, and the gods are able to defeat the Titans. The soon-to-be Olympians are able to defeat the Titans, and they are able to banish them to Tartarus or pin Atlas beneath the world. or beneath the sky, holding up the sky, or whatever other punishment each different Titan is given, blah, blah, whatever, you get it. And that, and thus ends what is called the Titanomachy, the war between the god, the soon-to-be Olympians, and the Titans. Titanomachy. There's your word for the day. And as Greek mythology goes on, of course, you know, we get so many wonderful and terrible stories of how the new generation, the current generation of gods, the Olympians, go on to have their own children with each other and mortals, and a whole bunch of shit goes down, and the primordial force of love that is Eros apparently holds his sway over Zeus, and the motherfucker can't wrap his tool to save his life. So, that is the Greek creation myth. And hey, while we're in the Mediterranean, why don't we jump a little south across the water to Egypt, and let's discuss the Egyptian creation myth. And I say the Egyptian creation myth, which is not entirely accurate, because it's really just a Greek creation, or a Greek creation myth, Egyptian creation myth, because there are several. Egyptian mythology, Egyptian culture is as old as sand, and there are actually a couple Egyptian creation myths. We're going to go over one of them, because that is all I have time for. It's very late when I'm recording, by the way, but that's not your problem. So there are several Egyptian creation myths, so we're going to go over one of the more popular ones, that being the sort of creation myth from Heliopolis, originating from Heliopolis. But before we do that, I want to cover a little neat thing. In one of the creation myths from across Egypt and across time, there are several different creator deities, one of them being a god known as Ptah, P-T-A-H, Ptah. And I don't know, this is just another little quick tangent for Ptah, a tangent, if you will. I'll wait for your applause. Ptah is a creator deity. And what's interesting about Ptah, other than being a creator deity, is in artwork, he is depicted mummified, similar to how we will eventually see Osiris, another important head deity later on in Egyptian mythology. I don't know. I was just doing the research. I found that neat, too. Lots of little neat things as you're going through mythology and wondering, what does that tell you about? What does that tell you about the culture this story came from? A creator deity who is depicted as mummified with green skin and sort of wrapped up, representing decay and preservation. He's a creator deity, yet he's mummified. He is depicted as dead and preserved. A creator deity bringing about the beginning of all things. I'll leave you with that little tidbit, because it kind of, this idea of beginning at the end or ending at the beginning kind of comes back later, but we'll get to that. Where we want to start with the Heliopolis creation myth is, again, in that primordial sea that existed before creation, before everything got started. Eventually out of that sea came the god Atum. Atum is essentially, and I'm also sorry if I'm mispronouncing any of these names, I'm not from Egypt. I'm sorry. But Atum is, at least in this view of the Egyptian pantheon, the ancient Egyptian world overall, Atum is essentially an over-deity, the first deity. And Atum creates these deities, Geb and Nut, the earth and sky, or earth and space. In several depictions of Geb and Nut, they are depicted as Nut as in a feminine form, sort of in a feminine humanoid form, stretched out over, like arching over on all fours, over the sort of planked out body of Geb representing Earth. And I just think that's fun. Any ancient travelers who come to Egypt see these deified depictions of their earth and sky, and they go, why is that lady not straddled over that guy, just kind of like arched over? Kind of weird. And then the Egyptians have to say, no, that's our sky. See? Sky over Earth. That guy's the Earth. And everybody coming to Egypt for the first time says, cool, got it. Makes sense, I guess. But essentially, in this creation, after Geb and Nut have come from Atum, there is the part of the story where they come together. as you do. Wink, wink. And they create their children, their godly children, Osiris, Set, Isis, and Nephthys. And there's even a story that they were so excited to get down to it and creating more gods that an eventual deity of air had to come between them and hold them apart. And if that's not love, I don't know what is. Apparently Eros had a hand in Egyptian mythology too. But now we have a new generation of gods, Osiris, Isis, Set, and Nephthys. Osiris kind of becomes the head of the pantheon of deities on Earth in the mortal realm, marries Isis, his sister. Again, every god did it. Don't worry about it. But he's eventually betrayed by his brother, Set. Essentially, Set comes to one of Osiris's parties and says, "Hey, everybody, I've got a fun party game. I have this coffin. Don't look into it. Just get into it. Anybody who can lay down and fit perfectly in this sarcophagus gets to keep it." And a couple of the gods are apparently cool with this. Give it a go. They try it out. Nobody fits except, of course, good old bro Osiris hops into the sarcophagus and fits perfectly, nice and snug. And probably while he's telling him how cool this sarcophagus is, Set closes the lid and tosses it in a river. Seals it up, tosses it in a river, says, "I'm the king now. Long live the king." Apparently he's played by Jeremy Irons. But Isis, Osiris's wife, goes to find the sarcophagus holding her beloved husband, her hubby, and try and free him. Set stops him, stops them, and actually destroys the coffin with Osiris in it, killing him, and tosses the bits and pieces of the coffin and Osiris out into the earth. Isis then has to say, "God damn it, Set," and track down the pieces, putting them back together and essentially creating the process of mummification by bringing the body back together in order to preserve it, in order to bring him back, in order to give him this everlasting form. And this idea of an everlasting form and everlasting presence was, of course, very important to the Egyptians, the ancient Egyptians. In this form, Osiris and Isis come together and produce their son, Horus, who eventually grows up big and strong, drinks its milk, and he grows up to defeat Set, overthrow him, and now Horus is the king of the earthly gods. Good job, Horus. You did your dad proud. But dad is still dead. Daddy Osiris, terrible way to say that. Osiris is dead. He's unable to stay within the mortal coils and has to leave behind the mortal realm, now with his son in charge, and he has to govern the dead. He becomes the god of the dead in the afterlife, looking after mortal souls that come after they die. Which is interesting, isn't it? Whole lot of death imagery. Whole lot of death imagery around Osiris. A big part of his story is being gifted a trick coffin by his brother, and then he becomes a foreshadowed god of the dead. So that's kind of how we get to the point where we are in the sort of quote-unquote present of Egyptian mythology. And there are several interesting points that are brought up in this, in these different creation myths that sort of come into play on a wider, more general scale in ancient Egyptian culture. Of course, like the idea of mummification and preserving the mortal form that can exist in the afterlife, that can preserve the existence of the soul, the several different parts of the soul in the afterlife. When Osiris's body is destroyed and he's killed and he's brought back, but he has to remain dead, but physically present. And among these important aspects that are brought about in this creation myth, I want to look at a little bit at Isis. Isis is a very important, very powerful deity in Egyptian mythology. We go on to see more of how she is important later in later myths, and how she gains more power and influence in the sort of pantheon, the greater pantheon. But an important part of Isis is that she is so tuned into magic in Egyptian mythology. She is a goddess of magic. And in Egyptian culture, belief, whatever you want to call it, there was this concept of magic, this concept or deity of magic known as Heka. And so Heka was this concept, magic was this concept that, like, comparing it to something like, you know, Christian beliefs, where, you know, magic in the hands of mortals is seen as sacrilegious and abhorrent to God, magic in Egyptian belief systems was not seen as sacrilegious. It was just this power that people could learn to manipulate, use to manipulate the world like the gods did. And so in this lineup, it kind of makes sense that Isis, a goddess of magic, is the one to bring back Osiris, not only as his loving wife, but also a goddess of magic, a goddess representing this concept that gives power to mortals. It also gives power to Osiris to preserve him after mummification. Isn't that neat? And talking about Osiris and talking about the afterlife, we can look at Ra. And you might ask, what does Ra have to do with the afterlife? Well, Ra, of course, is the sun deity, a very important deity in Egyptian mythology. But in that imagery of being a sun deity, it also plays into an imagery of cycles and eternity and being everlasting. So how he connects to the afterlife and Osiris, with my great transitions, is Ra, as the sun, was believed to exist in the mortal world for, you know, 12 hours a day, in his sun bark, overhead, in the sky, in space, you know, going across the horizon, going across the sky, shining his light upon mortal kind. And for the other 12 hours of the day, it's night and the sun is gone, and he is in the world of the dead. He is where we can't see him. But one of the important aspects of Ra is that he does come back. He does come back to life. He is, after essentially dying and going to the afterlife, he is reborn. He is this ever-present idea. Again, ever-presence and eternity, and the fact that you can be preserved after death is very important to Egyptians, ancient Egyptians, which then ties back in to chaos, because out of chaos came the world, and eventually figures like Ra represent how everlasting the world is. And to challenge that, there are entities like Apophis. I say entities like Apophis. There's Apophis. Apophis is this giant, monstrous, demonic snake creature, monster, representing a non-existence, essentially. The threat of non-existence. The threat of everything coming to an end. He is the world ender, essentially. He is a world-ending apocalyptic force in mythology, in Egyptian mythology. Because as Ra is dead in the afterlife, and he is going through those 12 hours in the underworld, sailing through the night, the other gods have to defend his body from Apophis, because Apophis is trying to eat Ra and bring about an end to that cycle and essentially return everything to nothingness, back to chaos, back to the primordial sea, back to nothing existing. And it's at that point that I can't help but go back to the beginning, where we mentioned Ta, the creator deity, mummified, beginning at the end, ending at the beginning, cyclical. Isn't everything cyclical? But with that, let's transition away from the Mediterranean, and let's go way up north to talk about Norse mythology and the creation myth of Norse mythology. And this one does not have quite as many versions as the Egyptian mythology. There are kind of two that are pretty much the same, with just different wording and different orders of, like, where stuff comes from and whatnot. Because, essentially, the best way to describe it without getting into detail is Christians are the worst, and I can say that because I'm Christian. Nobody get mad at me. Essentially, a lot of stories in Norse mythology were rewritten and retold from a Christian perspective later on. So there's a lot of Christian influence in our modern understanding of Norse mythology. But here's what we got. Essentially, like we said earlier, there is the empty gap at the beginning, that being Gnungagap. Gnungagap, emptiness, nothing's existing until something does exist. There's a figure called Snorri Sturluson. I'm going to double check I got that name right. Snorri Sturluson. I got it. God, I'm good. Snorri Sturluson was a later Norse Christian after that part of the world had been heavily Christianized, who wanted to record lots of Norse myths. And one thing that Snorri says in his tellings of Norse mythology was that in Gnungagap, eventually there came Niflheimr, or Niflheim, and Muspel, or Muspelheim. Niflheim, this world of fog and water and sea, and Muspelheim, or Muspel, this world of fire and heat and light. Eventually, these worlds begin to expand out, and different lengths and branches of them begin to expand out into the gap, and eventually these worlds meet. And as the fire and the fog and the waters meet, eventually from that mixing, it become these sort of drippings that come out of it form Ymir, this primordial giant, essentially. And when we say giant, that's a complex word in the image of in the context of Norse mythology, but for the time being, let's just call him a giant. Ymir. Also, at some point, don't ask me when, because nobody knows, because a lot of information is lost by the Christians. There's a big cow. There's a giant cow named Adhumla. Adhumla. So while Ymir, this big giant, is undergoing the creation of the first giants, or the first Jotun, Adhumla, the big cow, is going across the world that doesn't really exist yet and begins to lick out the ice. And as the big cow licks away at the ice, there is revealed new deities. And eventually these new deities beget deities, and eventually we get the good old beloved Odin and his siblings Vili and Ve. For some unknown violent reason, Odin, Vili, and Ve kill Ymir and use his giant body, big old body, big old thick boy Ymir, they use his body to create the earth. You know, his blood becomes the waters, his eyelashes become the barrier around the earth. I don't know why they needed the eyelashes in particular. His flesh becomes the earth we walk upon, etc., etc. And essentially, that's how Earth, or Midgard, is made. And it's even how other races are born, other magical races and peoples are born, like the dwarves. The dwarves in Norse mythology that we get, you know, D&D dwarves and Lord of the Rings dwarves and all fantasy dwarves, they come from maggots. Essentially, it is said that maggots that begin to form in the flesh of Ymir eventually become dwarves. Isn't that fun imagery? But that's how the dwarves are made. And, you know, the dwarves and the giants and the gods are made. But eventually, we get humans. And it might be Odin, Vili, and Ve, or it might be Odin and two other figures known as Honir and Lodur, eventually find or create Asker and Imbla, as essentially our Adam and Eve of Norse mythology. Again, Christianization. Who knows? Who knows what facts occurred first? But either they are found or they are made out of driftwood that Odin, Honir, and Ludir, or Odin, Vili, and Ve, find in the water. And they make the first humans out of this driftwood. And a neat little point, the driftwood from which humans are made, Asker and Imbla, is said to be driftwood from an ash tree. You know what else? You know what other important tree in Norse mythology is an ash tree? Yggdrasil, the world tree, the great tree that connects several of the many realms of existence. And I mention that little point, that little shared ash tree origin, because I find it neat, and we actually get, weirdly enough, like more importance of wood as the three Norns, the sort of like kind of analogous figures to the Fates in Greek mythology. Let's see if I can pronounce the names. Urdr, Verdandi, and Skald, the three Norns, again, sorry for my pronunciation, are said to carve fate, the stories of fate, into wood. I don't know. I just made this note because I noticed lots of importance of wood. I know I had big philosophical views as to what the other coincidences and the other mythologies meant. I don't really have one for this one. Make it up yourself. Just a little note. Humans are made out of wood. Yggdrasil's made out of ash wood. Same wood. The Norns carve fate into wood. And you can even tie into, like, I don't know, when I was thinking about this, I thought about, ooh, Vikings like wood because it's what they made their longships out of. As if that's anything special. As if the Vikings were the only people to use wood. Sometimes I have good thoughts. Sometimes I think about boats, I guess. Just like the Vikings. But that's how humans come into play. How humans come into existence is they are either found randomly in random existence in the world, or they're made out of wood by the gods. Definitely Odin, and then two other people who are unconfirmed. And with the world made, with Midgard made, a figure known as Mundilfori makes the moon and sun, or the gods around the moons and sun, to be eventually chased around by two big wolves named Hati and Skoll. Interesting point. Going back to Muspel, it is said that the light and fires of Muspel are where we get the moon, sun, stars, and other heavenly bodies. Isn't that neat? But with that, I will close it there, because I feel like with those little bits and pieces laid out, we have a decent sense of how everything began in these mythologies and how everything has come together since. How we find ourselves in the quote-unquote modern day of these belief systems. How we got to the age of the Olympians, the generation of the Olympians. How we got to Horus as godly king of Earth, and Ra making his numerous laps around the mortal realm and beyond. And then how Odin made us out of some wood, and some big dogs are chasing around the sun and moon. I don't know. Did any of my tangents, you find any of those interesting? Is it just me? It's fine if it's just me. You don't have to lie to me. But I'll leave you with this call to action, dear audience. Do any of these stories mean anything to you? Do you pull anything from them? It is part of why I find these stories so interesting, because it is telling about the cultures they come from in some way, shape, or form. It has to be, because these stories don't occur in a vacuum. These stories, whether you believe them yourself or you see them as stories from the past from different cultures, these stories have to be told by somebody. These stories have to be written down in order to explain parts of the world or the culture that the storytellers find themselves in. So I think it's neat to examine the stories and try and identify what parts of the world or what parts of the storyteller's culture they're trying to explain in these stories. And we do the same thing with our own stories nowadays. And I think that's important. It's an important reason as to why these stories should survive. And it's why I'm doing my small part in helping them survive with my silly little podcast on my podcast. Now that Cole's not here. Now that I've killed him. What? I didn't say that. I'll put his body back together and mummify him later, and he can, I don't know, do all the podcast episodes in the afterlife. And then his son will come and throw me off the throne one day. But let me know what you think. I am genuinely interested to know. Like I said at the start, my curiosity in mythology came a lot from Rick Riordan, genuinely. You know, I first saw the Logan Lerman, Percy Jackson, Lightning Thief movie, and that, of course, got me into the books, and Rick Riordan's amazing writing and modernization of Greek mythology and the other mythologies he's told stories within gave me an appreciation for mythology, gave me an interest in studying more of it on my own or finding other depictions of it, and that interest in mythology eventually led on to my interest in history, and my interest in history and mythology and the stories told within other cultures gave me an appreciation for understanding other cultures and how they tell these stories. And I hope, you know, openness to how other people see the world has made me somewhat of a more empathetic person. Maybe. I hope. You decide. Tell me in the comments. Am I a good person? I don't know. Yeah, that's what I'll leave you with. What do you take from these stories, and am I a good person? But with that, I hope you had a great time. I thought this was interesting. Good to be on my own for my first solo episode. And I guess you guys can have Cole back for the next episode. I guess. Maybe. We'll see what happens. But otherwise, don't forget to be unquestionably nerdy. Good night.